Am 12. August 1979 starben in Merseburg in Sachsen-Anhalt zwei Vertragsarbeiter aus Kuba, Raul Garcia Perret und Delfin Guerra. Die Initiative 12. August hat sich der Aufarbeitung der rassistischen Tat und der Erinnerung an die beiden Getöteten verschrieben. Eine Sprachnachricht dieser Initiative ist aktuell Teil einer Ausstellung.
Botschaft der Familie Garcia Perret, Santa Clara, 5. August 2020. Raul war ein ehrlicher Mann, ein Arbeiter von unbeirrbarem Charakter und er mochte nicht besonders den Krach oder Streit. Er war sehr ernst, hing sehr an seiner Mutter und kümmerte sich sehr um seine jüngeren Brüder und Schwestern. Das letzte Mal, als wir alle zusammenkamen, war 1979. Ein paar Tage vor seiner Abreise hatten wir eine kleine Abschiedsfeier bei einem unserer Onkel. Nach seiner Reise hörten wir nur noch von ihm durch seine Postkarten, die er uns schrieb. Die Wünsche unserer Familie sind, weiterhin mit euch Kontakt zu bleiben, zu kommunizieren und dass ihr in Merseburg weiterhin erinnert, so wie ihr es bisher getan habt. Wir sind unglaublich dankbar für das, was ihr bisher getan habt. Wir würden auch gerne eines Tages wissen, wie der Tathergang, all die Ereignisse mit unserem Bruder abgelaufen sind. In diesem Moment des Gedenkens möchten wir allen hier Anwesenden sagen, dass Rauls Familie euch allen für euer Engagement, euer Dasein von ganzem Herzen dankt. Wir fühlen uns geehrt und dankbar. Ihr erhaltet von uns, der ganzen Familie, eine große und geschwisterliche Umarmung. Auf bald, Schwestern und Brüder in Merseburg. Familie Garcia Perret von seiner Mutter Rosa Perret und seinen Geschwistern Olga und Jesus Perret.
Ein Brief an die Initiative 12. August von den Angehörigen des Vertragsarbeiters Raul Garcia Perret, der in Merseburg 1979 gestorben ist. Und diese Sprachaufnahme, die ihr gerade gehört habt, die ist aktuell hörbar im Jüdischen Museum Berlin und zwar im Rahmen einer künstlerischen Arbeit von Thalia Feldmann. Verschiedene Betroffene, Angehörige und Überlebende rechter Gewalttaten kommunizieren miteinander mittels Sprachnachrichten. Die Taten umfassen den Zeitraum von 1979 bis heute und zeigen damit die Kontinuitäten rechten Terrors in Deutschland ebenso auf wie die Stärke der Betroffenen. Diese vernetzen sich und sind solidarisch untereinander. The violence we have witnessed carries a weight on our hearts, heißt die Arbeit von Thalia Feldmann, die in Berlin ausgestellt wird, weil Feldmann dafür den diesjährigen Dagesch-Kunstpreis gewonnen hat. Wir haben mit der Künstlerin gesprochen, sowie mit dem Hauptkurator des Jüdischen Museums Berlin, Gregor H. Lersch. Das Gespräch ist in englischer Sprache.
Thalia creates a kind of living archive of messages of people affected by right-wing terror, by initiatives against right-wing terror, and different people. And she makes the continuity of these attacks, she makes it experienceable, like it's an experience if you go through it. You hear the voices, you see the visualization of the voices, you see the city maps in a very abstract way, so you can make links into time and space and in between to the people who are speaking to each other. So it's a multimedia installation that is, I would describe also as an activist art, because it really wants to name issues and problems and to change the viewpoint of society on certain issues.
Activist art is a keyword maybe that links this year's title of the Dagesch Art Prize, which is in German Wehrhafte Kunst. Maybe you can translate it by defensive art, protective art. For sure it means strength, so something like strong art. How can you connect with this title, Thalia? How can you connect this title with your work?
Yeah, it just makes a lot of sense to me that it would that it would be considered a form of standing its ground or of maybe not even just defensive, but offensive as well. And I think for a lot of the voices in this piece, they're all messages that have been sent over the last year between survivors of right-wing terror, between families of victims of right-wing terror, between initiatives fighting against right-wing terror. And they're all sent to one another on days of commemoration, on court dates, on protest dates, because of the coronavirus that kept us all apart from one another, from being there in person. It didn't keep people from sending these messages and raising their voices in solidarity and resilience with one another. I think for me, this question of how do we stop the violence, how do we defend but also fight this kind of terror is really here in listening to these voices, in hearing these voices, in questioning the ways that the justice systems and law enforcement have dealt with these voices, with these families, with these survivors, with the victims, and really questioning that and questioning our place in that as a society in how we need to change. And I feel like in a very big way, what these voices are opening for us all is this opportunity to tune into the world differently, to think of and imagine a time when this violence will end. Yeah, so I think in that sense, it connects to this title very much of ending the violence.
You already defined it as a living archive, Gregor Lersch. The artwork is documentary in the sense that it shows a network of survivors, of people affected by right-wing murder, right-wing terrorism. Among others, there are voices from Hanau, voices from Erlangen, where in 1980 the anti-Semitic murder of Frieda Pöschke and Shlomo Levin took place. Voices from Merseburg, where in 1979 two so-called Vertragsarbeiter from Cuba, Raul Garcia Paret and Delfin Guerra, were killed. All these voice messages are kind of interwoven and connected. What was the aim to show the connection and the networks between these different cases, different times, different people?
I can start with the connection between incidents, for example, in Hanau and in 1980 in Erlangen in the case of the murder of Shlomo Levin and Frieda Pöschke. And I think this is, for me, is one of the key messages of this installation. In the context of the murders of the NSU, in most of the cases, the police and the organs and the Verfassungsschutz, they started to look for the perpetrators close to the victims. And even if there were some hints of right-wing perpetrators, they didn't look for this. This was already the same 1980 with Shlomo Levin and Frieda Pöschke. There were also hints that there was a right-wing terrorist active, but there was the same. It was first looked around the Jewish friends, the Jewish people, the Jewish community, who could have been an enemy of Shlomo and Levin. And this interconnectivity is a continuity in time, which shows how in German society, in German police, it's the existence of this right-wing terror is denied, but on the other hand, it's very obvious that it's all the time there. And this is through these links in the installation, because they are communicating with each other these events and also the people who are dealing with these events right now. And this makes these connections visible. This is, for me, one of the examples why this interwovenness, like you called it, is a very important part in the installation.
Yeah, I think it's just very much like what Gregor was saying, that so often when these attacks happen, they are framed as single attacks, as single perpetrator or single incidents, when that's clearly not the case. And if we continue to call these incidents like that, then what hope do we have of preventing them in the future? And I guess another example, like what Gregor was saying, is the family of Burak Bektash. Burak Bektash was killed by a neo-Nazi in 2012 in Berlin. And his family fought for clarification, for investigation, which was lacking. And then it became to light not so long later that the same neo-Nazi that killed Burak killed another young man, Luke Holland. And so I think what we carry is the weight of knowing that if only Burak's death had really been investigated and the real perpetrators charged, perhaps Luke Holland would still be alive. And I think you can say that too for the case of Walter Lubka. If the attack on Ahmed E in 2016 had really been investigated, perhaps Walter Lubka would still be alive. And I think in a lot of ways, that is part of this weight that we carry, but not just the voices in this piece, but also just us as a community, as a society, as a country, as a world. So that also, I think, plays a big role in this and in what these voices are saying and really urgently asking for.
In the center of this artwork, there's voice messages. And this is interesting because when we talk about right-wing terrorism, right-wing violence in Germany, the voices of the victims, of the people affected for a long time were silenced and were even told that they are liars. With this kind of violence, they had to deal, some call it second trauma, and now you bring in these voice messages as the medium of your art. What does it mean to give voices, or maybe you use a better verb?
Well, I think a really big part of this is that in a really strong way, this narrative has to change. The fact that perpetrators are so often named in the media and in society, and so many people can name the perpetrators in the NSU, but they can't name the victims. And not only can't they name the victims, they can't name their families. And I think that's a really big part of this project as well. Here you have the affected, the families that are in some ways left battling city officials for the right to remember their loved ones in the way that they deserve to be remembered, battling law enforcement for proper investigation and accountability, battling justice systems that refuse to acknowledge really the racist and anti-Semitic structures that allowed for this violence to happen. In that sense, what this work is really saying is this has to change. And not only that, but these people are incredibly strong. Despite everything that has happened to them, they continue to fight. I think that's also, for me, a big part of this, showing this many instances of violence over time. And yet people from Erlangen and from Merseburg in 1979 to Hanau are still fighting. Like, they haven't given up. And I think that's also very important to note in this work as well.
I would like to add perhaps that these voices are a lot about listening. And it's something that also in other discourses at the moment are very important, that the German majority society listens to the perspective of the other, which is also in other topics that we are dealing with here in the museum, a very current and very difficult debate at the moment. If you see what happening around the memory discourse, so also if we have a huge discussion ongoing on the topic of the multidirectional memory, so who's memorizing how, what, and is it the only valid narrative, or are there more valid narratives at the same time? And I think the work of Talia is also much about this, how we remember, who remembers what, and how we can listen to the remembrance of different groups, different initiatives, different people.
Yeah, maybe connected to what you just said, Gregor Lersch, and connected also to this term of living archive, why is it important to have such pieces in a museum?
Why? Because the artworks doesn't get you through the information or through the documentation. What we rather do in our historical exhibition, we explain a lot, we give a lot of data, we also let people speak, but we always try to be correct and to give the most important information, and you have to really be careful also how you put historical things together. But if you do an artwork, or if you show an artwork, if you present an artwork, you can rather work with the experience of the visitor, with the emotions of the visitor. And sometimes I think this is as important as to give information and data. For example, in the case of Talia's installation, there are moments where you don't see the maps that are printed on hanging nets. So in some moments you don't see the city maps, but if you do one or two steps, they appear and you see them. And then you start to ask yourself which city it is. And then there is a list beside there are the city names with also with the dates of incidents. So you can start yourself, do the next step and to ask yourself, do I know about it? What happened there? And I think this way of getting information and also this way of dealing with contemporary issues and with the topic of the Jewish Museum, which is a lot about the relations of minority groups and a very difficult history and a relation to a complex present. So I think this fits very much into what we do in the museum.
Talia, it's not the first work you do as an artist that deals with right-wing terrorism, its victims, white supremacist terrorism. And it's not only that you as an artist dealt with this topic, but as a survivor of the anti-Semitic, racist and misogynist shooting in Halle, you were also a co-plaintiff in the trial against the perpetrator that took place last year. And you as a co-plaintiff used this trial to articulate, to talk about the consequences for society and so on. So you already raised your own voice several times. Why is it important for you to bring together these different aspects, like political activism, artistic work, in this kind of reality that is included as well in the artistic work?
I often actually think about the theorist named Douglas Crimp, and he wrote very often about the AIDS crisis. And he started a program during the crisis in the United States that combated narratives, really harmful narratives of the LGBTQ community, with visual material, visual information. And he talks about the importance of doing that as a means of saving lives. And I think for me, in really looking at this history, showing this data, looking at these like timelines, is so important. But it's also so important to see that there are people behind that data, and that in displaying this information, I feel that urgency, like Crimp did, that in doing this, you are really trying to change this narrative that is negative, that is, even, I guess you could even say, this narrative of the victim. What does it mean to be a victim? And I think Ibrahim Arslan says it very well in one of his messages that's in this work. Ibrahim is a survivor of an arson attack in 1992, where three of his family members were killed in Mon. And he says that being a victim does not mean that you are passive or weak. We are the main witnesses to what happened. We are strong and we are active. And I think that in a lot of ways, like kind of combining this idea of saving lives through offering this information, of making it clear that there are people and hearts behind that data, and that being a victim does not mean that you are weak. And I think that these voices really show that. They showed it to me and they strengthened me. And I think that they are the voices we really should be listening to right now.